So hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. It's Tuesday, 4 o'clock, so I'm always here and you're always there, and that's really great. I think you know, in terms of how Voices runs, that we're always focusing on who's on the front lines of the battle. We're going to have Ajamu Baraka, who's been doing a lot of work around human rights, and he's written an important article in the Black Agenda Report. And we're going to talk about not just Ferguson, but the more fundamental question of what do we do about it, which is very, very hard. So we're happy to have an internationalist perspective. Okay, so do we have Ajamu Baraka? Yes, we do. Well, we've been trying to find this brother, so very happy. Ajamu, nice to have you on the show.
Hi, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I think we share a lot of very common politics. Ajamu wrote a terrific article in Black Agenda Report. He writes a lot. This one's called The Darren Wilson Non-Indictment, Resistance to Oppression is a Human Right. And Ajamu, I want to spend this time, we have a pretty good chunk of time, trying to talk about the state of the movement more than the state of the critique, because I have a very good quote from your article saying that the task of the African-American resistance movement is not to worry about sitting down with white people infected with the disease of white supremacy, but to build the capacity of black, poor, and working-class folks to resist the intensifying expressions of repressive state power directed at our people. From that base, we can and should talk about building coalitions with other oppressed communities and people who are ready to take on the task of opposing the settler capitalist state at every level. Just in literally 2 minutes, why do you call it the settler capitalist state?
Well, because I think historically, and I think, but that's what we are in fact dealing with. We are dealing with a settler colonial state, as in the same way as the settler colonial state that was set up in Canada and Australia and New Zealand and Kenya at one point and Algeria. This is part of the colonial expansion of Europe, but for the America, for the U.S., it was something even more special. That is, that the expansion of Europe into North America was part of the very beginning of the process where Marx talks about the process of primitive accumulation. That this invasion of the Americas served as a foundation for the whole development of the colonial capitalist system. And the form that invasion took in North America was a settler colonial state that progressively expanded itself across the territory that we refer to as the so-called United States.
Now, Ajamu, the reason I asked you to say that is because one of the problems we're having today is that master narrative has been lost in the movement. People are not talking that way. When I got involved in the movement with the Congress of Racial Equality, the average person was talking about indigenous genocide, slavery, stealing of northern Mexico, U.S. and Vietnam. That was understood. As a result, we saw ourselves breaking with the liberals very early because we didn't want to make a better United States. We wanted to basically challenge U.S. imperialism in the interest of people all over the Third World. So going back to some of your proposals, what is the state of the black movement today, which I know is a real hard question? I mean, I will start with a couple of observations that obviously in seeing the mass outrage going on around Ferguson, which is terrific, and seeing what happened in L.A., obviously some of the problems, because you said yourself that African Americans are finally awakening from an almost two-decade-long sleep, and the process reawakening the spirit of resistance for everyone, which I think is great and right. But now we get into the issue of the fight over hegemony as to who speaks for the black community, and the number of people who are out there now as media faces who are grabbing and, of course, talking about nonviolence and putting down the protesters. A lot of the people that we work with, young or not always so young, true black and Latino young working class people, still can't figure out how to get to the mic, how to get to even the conversations about the debate for alternate hegemonic proposals. What have you been thinking about that?
Well, I mean, as you laid out, Eric, these are some very difficult questions, both in terms of theory and practice. I see, you know, what you're referring to in terms of the kinds of faces that are now emerging as the voices of Ferguson, and even Ferguson itself as a symbol is now sort of a point of contention. And I think that because of the relative, to go to your question, where are we at with the Black Liberation Movement? I think that because of the relative weakness of the Black Liberation Movement, that movement that you referred to earlier that had a clear perspective on who we were, what we were up against, and where we needed to go, it was clear about who our allies was, who understood what the Black Liberation Movement meant within the context of the global struggle for liberation and for a new world. You know, because of the defeats that we experienced, you know, in the 1970s, institutionally we are very, very weak. And as a consequence of that, you find when these kinds of spontaneous rebellions emerge, where there's a spirit of resistance, where you see the bubbling up of a radical critique. Before that critique had even become consolidated, we find those same liberal forces that are able to sort of run to the head of the line, if you will, and begin to spin what's happening in the same old tired liberal framework. So it goes back to the real task of the moment, and that is the task of systematic, persistent political education and organizing. Now, I know that sounds relatively humdrum, not very romantic and all of that kind of stuff, but that kind of basic base building work has to still be the priority, because if not, we're never going to be able to, in fact, get to the mic, if you will, or to frame these issues in ways in which we are revealing the realities that people are facing as opposed to perpetuating myths. It boils down again to necessity for basic organizing. So
I agree with you. Let me just come right in with you on that, because this, you're listening to the voice of Ajamu Baraka, among other things, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and editor and contributing columnist for the Black Agenda Report. Ajamu, to build on that, I think that what you said about political education and organizing is absolutely critical, and I think what I've been trying to figure out is, and here's some positive news, is that in Los Angeles, to just give you an example, there's a struggle been going on around truancy and the police giving truancy tickets. And there's been a struggle going on about willful defiance in the schools as a so-called crime. There's been a struggle going on about the criminalization of everyday life in the schools. We now have a campaign called No Cars in LA, No Tanks in LA, No MTA Apartheid Passes in LA, and Not One More Deportation in LA. And what we're doing, based on exactly what you said, and using the term, by the way, Black Liberation Movement, which is dates us, but that's a good thing, is we are finding the ability to move up the scale about where we can contest with other forces. You know, we can't yet contest with Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or Barack Obama, or, you know, to even go to the mic. But we are at the microphone in front of the city council, in front of the school board. And I do think that building these urban and rural movements based on what you said, which is political education and organizing, including folks read this article as one example, I don't think it's humdrum at all. I completely support what you're saying.
And the challenge we have, though, is in our organizing activity to make sure that we don't make some of the mistakes that some of us made, you know, a few decades ago, that, you know, we got too narrow in our focus. And as weak as certain petty bourgeois forces were, because we didn't find ourselves in the same spaces where large numbers of the people were, we almost basically surrendered those numbers of people to these petty bourgeois forces. So we've got to be able to be involved in those kinds of struggles you just referred to. You know, we've got to be involved with issues that church folks are concerned with. You know, we've got to look at new forms of organization in which, you know, we never allow ourselves to get in an artificial debate like what happened down in New Orleans at one point right after Katrina, where the conversation was about should we build a political organization versus an organization that provides services. You know,
right.
We've got to transcend those kind of binaries. We've got to understand that if you're going to ground yourself in the realities of the people, in the masses of our people, of any oppressed people, especially at this moment in history when people are suffering the way they are now, we've got to remind ourselves of basic things. Like, for example, the Black Panther Party talked about, you know, until we are able to overthrow this system, we've got to have a survival program. So we've got to talk about what kinds of organizations that we build. We've got to build organizations that are political, but also have that other component too. We've got to have organizations that are providing some after-school daycare stuff, some after-school tutoring programs that can bring in, have programs that can help people to reentry back into the community once they come out of these prison cells. You know, we've got to have youth programs. We've got to have, you know, Saturday morning political education classes. We've got to have programs for the elders. So we've got to have stuff that allows people to be involved, but also for that deepens the community's ability to do for itself also, while at the same time we still make demands on the state. And because the state is taking our resources and diverting those resources to other places, we still get those struggles. But we've got to have different approaches to our organizing, I think. We've got to be where the people are, understand what the needs are, understand the material needs of our people, and build in a way in which we are really grounded with folks.
Well, let me ask you this, Ajamo, because I totally agree again with that. And the only reason, by the way, I talk about my own organization a lot, not at all in a self-promoting way. I hate that. But often because we're doing the things that other people are saying we should be doing. You know what I mean? So it's encouraging just to say, you're not crazy. You know, what you're saying is what we agree with and are trying to do. So I want to segue for a minute to this human rights UN conversation. We know, and you know so much better than me, the amazing history of Black people bringing their demands to the United Nations, and obviously whether or not we believe there's a Black nation, which I do, or whether or not Black people, you know, there's debates, but as I understand it, even to have status in front of the United Nations, you have to see yourself as an internally oppressed group in some relationship to the dominant government. And we know that there was a long history of W.E.B. Du Bois and Paul Robeson, and at one point the NAACP. We know that during the 60s that Malcolm talked a lot about bringing it to the United Nations. But having worked as in the NGOs with the United Nations, both at the World Conference Against Racism and then this next year in Johannesburg at the World Summit on Sustainable Development, boy, that's a hard nut to crack. Saying it and doing it is a different thing given U.S. hegemony, et cetera. So what do you think today, as a long warm-up, but what do you think today is the most advanced group of people or peoples, different groups? Are there people really thinking about an approach to the United Nations for Black people in the United States?
Well, not only are they thinking, there are efforts to, in fact, do that. In fact, that was part of a central component of the work that we were involved in at the U.S. Human Rights Network. We understood how to access the U.N. system. We understood that because the U.S., in its efforts to try to pretend to be a supporter of human rights, actually signed and ratified a few human rights treaties that then obligated them to have to report on the progress of those treaties, whether or not they were, in fact, adhering to the provision of those treaties. So that allowed us entry point to raise contradictions and point out some of the backward practices that the U.S. was involved in. And we're able to do that and frame our critique not just in terms of sort of a liberal violation of individual rights, but also to point out that there were collectivities. There were collectives that were being violated rights that basically African people in the U.S., indigenous people, Chicanos, there were these collective rights that were being violated by the U.S. So those efforts were, in fact, being made. The problem we have, though, is twofold. One is that some of the groups that were involved in those advocacy efforts, because it was heavily oriented toward these sort of legalistic approaches, you know, looking at these texts and framing the critique within the context of these U.N. texts.
Right.
And because we are dealing with governments, it became overly state-centered and legalistic and play right into the hegemony of these attorneys and these lawyers who were part of this effort. And so you get caught up into sort of a bureaucratic runaround where you expend these enormous amounts of energy, resources, time, lobbying at the UN in order to get, you know, the UN to make some comments about how screwed up the U.S. human rights record was. And then there was no real strategy on how to, in fact, use that in your organizing and educational work back on the ground. So that work has been done. And the other point, though, is even with the UN being aware of the fact that the U.S. is involved in human rights violations domestically, within the context of this current sort of belligerent status of the U.S. and the fact that it is in fact a rogue state in which international law and standards are unable to constrain its behavior internationally, who's going to call it to task in terms of what's happening internally, in terms of the UN? You know, no one. So while that area of work is important, it's part of the sort of a counter narrative that needs to be developed in terms of what's happening in this country and the role of the U.S. Globally, that, you know, as part of a war of position, if you will, ideologically, we could use those struggles to help to delegitimize the U.S. And its practices internally and also globally. You know, I try to caution people not to put too much weight in this UN stuff at this point.
Well, I think I have a lot of empathy with that point of view, which is not to say that I'm going to get involved in these debates, because there are people, obviously, who would say, yeah, you know, I don't know the situation well enough. But I do think that given that the United States is terrifying many of the other governments, they have a green room that they bring these people into, like it's like a police cell where they bring in the leaders of other countries. And they say, are you going to vote a certain way? Do you know how many CIA agents we have in your country? Do you know we know every faction in your department? We know you're hanging by a thread. We know your economy isn't doing very well. And they go back out and change their votes. But here's what I'm getting to. I think the demand about we want to take these human rights to the United Nations because black people are an internally oppressed group, I think has tremendous agitational and propaganda impact, whether or not you actually do it or not. Because I think the concept that there's a world out there, you know, there is a third world out there, and without arguing that the people doing it, I mean, the people doing it are great, but maybe for those that don't want to get involved in the intense struggle with the UN as a system, still could be pointing some of the agitational information about the whole history of black people taking this to the UN, because it just does at least snap your head around the fact that the black struggle is not trapped inside the United States of America. What do you think? I'm asking your opinion. You know, I'm just throwing it out.
I think that we're on the same page. I mean, I definitely agree. I guess I was just laying out that...
No, absolutely. You were laying out some of the contradictions of having a very intense tactical plan to actually win it.
Because, like you said, if that area wasn't that important, you wouldn't find the kinds of machinations that the U.S. state is involved in.
That's right.
In both the General Assembly and in some of the specialized bodies to make sure that people vote a certain kind of way.
That's right.
I mean, it's a very important part of their ideological sort of stance and part of the ideological struggle globally. So, yeah, no. And they spent a lot of time and money in doing this. I remember going, you know, I've been involved in doing this stuff for a long time, and going over to the UN back in the 80s, and there'd be one or two of us at some of these meetings, you know, but the U.S. government was sending in 14 people, you know.
That's right.
Just to lobby and stuff, you know, over something that you would think would be relatively mundane. But they, you know, they understood the full scope and importance of the ideological struggle. And that's what this stuff really is all about. So, it's an area that we should and we are involved in. I mean, look, part of the issue with Ferguson now is the kind of, I mean, you know, Ferguson brought the African-American problematic back into the international arena, something that had been taken out especially in the last 6 years, the ascendancy of Barack Obama.
Right.
Basically, around the world, it was concluded that basically black folks in the U.S. were content. We had now been fully integrated into the empire. We're in a post-racial era, and everything was hunky-dory, you know. And so, you know, we don't need to talk about black folks, you know, because that's being covered. But, you know, Ferguson reintroduced that back into the international arena. It helped to reawaken, to remind the world that basically, no, all of us have now been incorporated into the empire. There's been a long and glorious anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist struggle within this country, a revolutionary tradition, and that tradition has been weakened, but has not been completely destroyed, and we're still here. And that tradition understands its connection and responsibility to the world. So this has been fantastic. So part of the response from the state is that meeting that they pulled together yesterday, trying to bring in these elements from Ferguson and for a photo op that, you know, can say to the world that, you know, the state is on top of these issues, and these issues can be resolved within the democratic process of the U.S. You know, all that is part of that whole ideological strategy. So, you know, that area is ripe and is more ripe than people even realize.
Well, I think we really agree on that. I mean, we had conversations with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he and I were talking about around his idea of, I keep saying this, but about menticide, about black youth being separated from their revolutionary history, and as a result, having no ideological, spiritual, emotional understanding of how to behave. In other words, they could be angry, but separated from this amazing history that's not very old, that the system wants so badly to suppress, that I think that a lot of the work you're doing in the realm of ideology is very important. And given that we got 4 or 5 or 6 minutes, I want to cover a couple of things. One I want to ask you about, that I'm very concerned that in the 60s, a whole lot of white people responded to the black liberation movement. And I'll tell you, in Los Angeles, that all the white people want to talk about is Occupy or Elizabeth Warren or Citizens United or the 1% against the 99%. They're obsessed with, in my opinion, their own perception that they're running the movement now, which is making it very hard when we bring 500 people down to a city council meeting or an MTA meeting, and there is not one white liberal supporting 500 black and Latino workers, students, and bus riders. What's been your experience in terms of struggling, you know, with the black intelligentsia, I mean, with the white intelligentsia or with the white liberals or the white youth? What's been your experience in trying to get them to re-understand the importance of the National Liberation Movement?
It's been similar to your experiences and observations. I mean, we've seen over the last, and it's got even more intense over, the last 15 years or so, in which there's even a new generation of black and white folks who have never even seen independent black organizations, let alone to consider a position that says that unless the African-American revolutionary process is centered in this country, that there's a real possibility that revolutionary politics are not going to develop in this country and not going to go that far. So even entertaining that conversation is something that no one is really doing anymore, because that would even be, you have to get past a whole lot of other stuff even to get to that conversation right now. So it is a very difficult situation right now because of what has happened with the white left and the black left to a certain extent, in which racial politics have been confused, issues around national liberation, national oppression. So when we try to, among ourselves, to get ourselves organized as African people and linking up with other oppressed colonial people, even in some quarters, that's seen as divisive or whatever. And that is a strange situation, but it's real, and it's really undermining our ability to take advantage of the kind of crisis we see in this country at the present moment.
Well, Jamu Baraka, it's great to have you on Voices from the Frontlines. We have about 2 more minutes. What books are you reading, music you're listening to, films you're seeing that you like?
Well, in terms of books, I'm really, because I'm living here in Latin America now, I'm really reading a lot of the work that's being produced by some of these theoreticians and revolutionaries who are making an argument that the center of a real anti-imperialist struggle and the creation of a new world exists at the margins of European modernity. And so I'm reading a lot of the Latin American scholars who are trying to deal with some of these questions and suggesting that if there's going to be a new world, it's going to come from the so-called third world.
And give me one book, if somebody, because I totally agree with that. Is there a particular book you encourage our listeners to at least check out?
I can share some authors. Walter Mignola, M-I-G-N-O-L-O, a Puerto Rican brother, Rafi Goosefellow, I can't pronounce his first name. There is Catherine Walsh. So these are at the beginning of some of those. I can't remember some of these.
That's all right. We'll get a couple, and then we'll, you know, with the miracle of Google, it'll get us to the next step. So, John, well, listen, where are you living in Latin America, if I can ask?
I'm in Cali, Colombia.
Cool. Well, in the miracle of emails, you seem just as close as you were down the street. So, John Baraka, very nice to have you on the show. I mean, I think today we're addressing some of the so-called problematics of the black movement. We know that there's a tremendous uprising, but the complex stories of what are we going to do about it is a big part of what Voices from the Front Lines is about. And writers like John Baraka are very important for that conversation. It's really great to have you on the show.
It's really been nice to be here. Hope I can come back again.
We'll make that happen. So this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. The producer is Crystal McMillan. The engineer is Nigel Richardson. Alan Minsky is the program director. And check us out in a couple of different ways. Go up on the website, please, www.voicesfromthefrontlines. We check to see if you registered. That would mean a lot. Send me an email at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. I generally answer them all. eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. About maybe today's show and what you thought about it. Ideas for future shows, recipes, whatever you want to talk about. eric@voicesfromthefrontlines. Next week, we're going to have a fun drive. And over the next 2 or 3 weeks, I'm going to be doing some programming to make sure that the fun drive still has a lot of Voices politics. So take good care of yourselves. Enjoy this holiday period. Fight the system. All power to the people. And look out for somebody else who might need your help at this time. It's a very lonely, sad time for a lot of poor and oppressed people. Take good care of yourself.
Without exemption, eyes will hand each trot course, each careful footstep along the byway, yeah. Oh, much more than this, I did my way. Yes, there were times I'm sure you knew when I bit off.
You've been listening to Voices from the Frontline on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, celebrating over 50 years of independent broadcasting. Thanks to you, our listener supporters. Coming up next is Ian Masters and Background Briefing. Keep it tuned.
I faced it all, and I stood tall.